Hello, everybody. Dr. Lonnie Stewart here from the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. Are you a physical therapy student about to start studying for the National Physical Therapy Examination? Or maybe you're a professor, a program director, or a clinical instructor who teaches DPT students preparing for the NPTE? Either way, we would recommend checking out our sponsor, NPTE Final Frontier, and the community they've built around preparing for and succeeding on the NPTE. That exam and the preparation that goes along with it can be long, tedious, difficult, and stress-inducing, but it doesn't have to be. NPTE Final Frontier has the tactics and resources to help address all of the usual barriers. They even have scholarships to help with NPTE study courses, FSBPT registration fees, and even research opportunities. And if that's not enough, they're even donating to the very first annual HET Podcast Scholarship to be awarded at the end of every year. Go to npteff.com for all of the details and use code HET for 10% off all purchases. Links to both the NPTE Final Frontier and their scholarship options are available in the show notes. And now, let's get ready to learn.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. F. Scott Field, and I've got with me today very special guest, a longtime friend, mentor of mine, hero of mine, somebody who taught me when I was coming up through the ranks, and it was still a master's program way back in the dinosaur days. One of my former professors, Dr. Blaze Williams. Blaze, how the heck are you, man?
Awesome, Scott. Thanks for allowing me to spend some time with you today. Really happy to be here.
Yeah, this has been a long time coming. I'm so excited for this. I've been waiting forever to show people a path that physical therapists can take that is a little bit outside the box. And I love how you got there. So tell us a little bit about your educational background, how it led you to where you are today.
Like you said, it's not a linear path. My undergraduate was in biology, environmental science. I thought that I was going to become the next Jacques Cousteau and spend some of my life on the seven seas, diving below, you know, and trying to understand how the earth and the sea interacted. I did that for a little bit. Actually had some research positions after college. But like many research labs, funding becomes difficult. And so when that funding dried up, so did my position. And so I came back home and was put into position to where I had to get a job. And so prior to going to college and in college, I was a water safety instructor, taught swimming lessons and also taught people to become lifeguards. And so one of my former students' parents was working as a physical therapist at our local hospital and said, "Hey, there's a job in physical therapy. Would you like to come and become a tech?" I said, "Great. It sounds great," because I needed the money. And then my next question was, "Hey, what's physical therapy?" Because I didn't know. And so I went and I worked in a hospital and I did all the, you know, went total joint replacements, strokes, people, wound care, pediatrics. I saw sort of the breadth of what physical therapy was at that time. And I said, "Hey, this is pretty cool. I like this. I'm going to apply to school." I had most of the prerequisites I needed. I applied to school. Fortunately, I was able to get in. In fact, like you, back in those days, it was a master's program. In fact, that program, I went to University of Maryland, that program was just transitioning from a bachelor's to a master's. So after my first year, I actually received a bachelor's in physical therapy, which didn't allow me to do anything, but I had that second degree. While I was in physical therapy school, wasn't really totally able to shake that research bug that I had from undergraduate. And a lady named Mary Rogers came to be faculty there. She was a biomechanist who had trained under Peter Cavanaugh, who was a well-respected researcher at Penn State and did a lot of the early running related research. But she was a biomechanist who studied all kinds of things: running, diabetic foot pathology, upper extremity biomechanics, and people who are doing wheelchair propulsion. And so I was just interested in the work that she was doing. And so I went to work in her lab. Long story short, I graduated from PT school, under her sort of mentorship was she it really encouraged me to go and get my PhD, which I did. Did my PhD at the University of Delaware under a lady named Irene Davis, who a lot of people know her work, and she did a lot of running related research. And so was able to start to understand running and running related injuries, running related performance and biomechanics. And that's that was kind of where my education, or at least my formal education, ended before I went on to take my first faculty position at East Carolina.
Yeah. So let's talk about the next phase. You were big in research and running, man. You were, big into gait and you worked with dancers. You worked with a ton of really cool populations. But you ran a couple of run labs from start to finish. So tell us a little bit about how you got into that.
Yeah. So like I said, I cut my teeth in my PhD on with Irene, and running was really where I had the most, I guess, understanding at that point. So running was kind of my thing. And when I went to East Carolina, there really wasn't a lot going on there as far as research went, and particularly biomechanics research. So I was able to work closely with the faculty that was there and work with the dean at that time to get some space in the building that we were in and create a biomechanics lab there. It was modest. It was we had to do a lot of the work ourselves. We got some force plates in the ground. We got some cameras back in the day mounted up on tripods, and fortunately had some willing and able PT students who wanted to learn more about biomechanics, because we didn't have a PhD program. We scratched and clawed to get that lab set up and to get the work going. And over the first 3 or 4 years, we were able to really start to get some good projects. At the same time, I started doing some work with some folks over in the medical school, trying to understand how people with diabetic peripheral neuropathy walked, and what were some of the things that we could do to better engage them, either from a physical therapy or from a medical perspective. So I always kind of kept these parallel paths of research going. Like you mentioned, dancers. Running was the constant. It was the thing that I had the best knowledge of and felt the most comfortable with. But I always kept these parallel paths of research, trying to understand how people with diabetes walked, or how dancers moved, or how people who were obese moved, or soldiers who had been either had a blast injury and they had balance issues. All of those things were things that I kind of kept on the side. Sometimes they were just passion projects, and sometimes they were things that helped me get a little bit of money into the lab so I could support students. But the lab at ECU came after about 5 or 6 years, when we got a new building, and I had built a little bit of credibility for myself and said, hey, we need a running focused lab here. Fortunately, we were able to get that space, and we were able to design it and build it. And we had a very large space that allowed us to study running, but also allowed us to study all of these other things and collaborate both within the department, across the School of Health Science, and then outside of that school.
Yeah, that new building came the year after I graduated, mind you.
Yeah.
So,
Thanks for that. Yeah.
So you weren't finished, though, with running. After ECU, you went on to do even more research in running, right?
I did. So I was at ECU for 12 years, had a great stint there, and left not under bad circumstances, but my family, we had a young family at that time, and the rest of my extended family was in the Richmond, Virginia area. So I had the opportunity to move to Richmond, Virginia, had been working closely with a couple of our vendors to create some products and even some just capabilities for other researchers that were unique, so that we could measure people more efficiently or more quickly or more repeatedly with the types of techniques we were using. And so when I got to Virginia, that really all came to a head, and we were able to build something called the VCU Run Lab. And that was a lab that was research at its core, but we served the community. We served the athletics department. We had a relationship with the hospital and with the health system there, so that they could make referrals to us. And then we had relationships with other sort of customers in the area. The great thing about it was we were able to kind of support ourselves as a lab. I brought in some traditional grants, but primarily we, through these contracts and through the relationships that we had, we funded ourselves. We were almost a startup within a university, which was a bit weird. Even the departments that we were serving didn't really know what to do with that, because normally, as you know, departments are asking for money and they're putting budgets together and asking for money from the college or from the university. We were actually bringing in money and they didn't know what to do with that money.
Well, what do we do with this, right?
Yeah, no one's ever made money for us. I worked through my department chair and through the other department chairs that we were associated with, so that money could go back into funding supplies we needed, computer resources we needed, funding travel for students, funding research projects for students, funding students to actually come through the lab. So we actually just basically functioned as a startup nonprofit where we just put the money right back into the lab. And that was great. We worked with local run clubs. We worked with small high school groups that came through. There were multiple people. There were people coming from Florida and internationally, like Olympic hopefuls that were coming through there. So it ran the gamut from people who were just starting to want to run their first 5K all the way to people who were competing in the Olympics. And it was an incredible adventure for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you just don't hear that kind of model. You really don't. So, I mean, to me, it's just like amazing. I mean, absolutely awesome that you can take something like that and turn it into what you did. I mean, you know, like you said, just an incredible experience. And I noticed that you're wearing your swoosh on your golf shirt there. Tell everybody what you're doing now for your occupation. Still got the physical therapist and PhD credentials, but what are you doing now? What's your title?
Yep. My title is Director of Field Services within the Nike Sport Research Lab. So the Nike Sport Research Lab is a sports science lab made up of around 100 people. It's the largest sports science lab of its kind within industry, focused on serving our athletes as well as creating better product for everyday athletes and for the athletes that are our sponsored athletes. My role is to take all that expertise, or at least represent a lot of that expertise, and create services that serve the everyday athlete. So a lot of the people that are working in the lab, or a small group of people that work in the lab, serves our elite athletes. So if LeBron comes into the lab and needs something, we have people that serve him, and we give him the best service there is, from biomechanics expertise, physiological expertise, psychological expertise, you name it, dietitians, whatever it takes. And my job is in part now to leverage some of that knowledge that we have of 40 years of serving these types of athletes and bring it to people every day, primarily runners.
That's awesome, man. And again, keep in mind, this was from physical therapists to now big wig in sports science for one of the largest corporations in America. I mean, I love that. I love the journey. I love the story. What kind of advice would you give for people in the healthcare field that maybe are considering going a different path and taking a different route?
One of the things that I still love doing, and I've always gotten to do as part of my career, is to talk to people who are interested in going to physical therapy as a profession. Yesterday, I had a 16-year-old who I sat down with for an hour and talked to him about physical therapy as a profession. And I always end up saying the same thing is I think that I truly believe that physical therapists have the best understanding of the human body and how the human body moves in everyday society. And all physical therapists are trained to assess that and, you know, monitor that and then bring people back to full function. So we are fully, absolutely the best at understanding that. And so my advice oftentimes to young people and then people who are even looking outside of that is, if you become a physical therapist and, or you are a physical therapist, believe that you are the best at understanding human movement and how humans interact with their environment.
And now for a quick shout out to our newest sponsor, Varela Financial. If you're a physical therapist and you have student loan debt, you got to talk to these guys. What makes them unique is that they view financial planning like running hurdles on a track. And for PTs, the first hurdle many of us run into is student loan debt. Varela Financial will help you get over that hurdle. They not only take the time to explain to you which plans you individually qualify for and how those plans work, but they also take the time to show you what your individual case looks like, mapped out within each option. So if you're looking for help on your student loan debt or any area of personal finances, we recommend working with them. I use Varela Financial personally, and they were able to help me lower my student loan repayment from about $1,800 a month down to about $135 per month simply by finding the right repayment plan that best fit me, my family, and our life goals. You can check them out at VarelaFinancial.com. Link is in the show notes if you need it for reference, and tell them the HET podcast crew sent you. And now, back to the show.
And that anybody who needs to have information about that, you are a value to them. So Nike specifically, who wants to understand how to make the best shoes and sportswear apparel for people, they need to understand how people move. So having a physical therapist who is somewhere in that process, whether it's doing research or whether it's advising how these products get in the hands of those individuals, I think is crucial. So I don't think there's any limitations to just because you're a physical therapist doesn't mean that you have to be treating patients all the time. If that's what you love, then you should do that. But the knowledge that you have as a physical therapist allows you to interact with tons of different organizations.
Yeah. I love that. I think one of the things that I've realized over the years is that not only physical therapy school, but then, you know, into my terminal degree, my educational doctorate, like there's skill sets that we learned along the way that don't even pertain to physical therapy that are just good to have for any job, right? Time management, prioritization, project management, right? And interaction, yep. Soft skills and communication, right? All of these things set you up to be really successful at anything you do. Then you throw our knowledge of the human body and movement in there. And the world is your oyster, man. I mean, you can do anything, you know? And so I think me personally, just what I'm feeling and hearing and seeing in the future a little bit as we move, you know, into these other options, population health, I think, is going to be a really big, you know, part for physical therapists to kind of fit into. Trying to help, you know, people a little further upstream and trying to teach them how to stay healthier and move better and, you know, do things before we get sick and injured and you know, have these issues. And I think that, you know, we as physical therapists need to start having a place at the table when it comes to discussions like this, right? When it comes to movement science, when it comes to biomechanics, when it comes to population health, all of these options are out there for us. We just need to realize that we're the only ones that really need to give ourselves permission to do it. You know?
Yeah, totally. Think about this, Scott. I don't know if you're an Apple person, but if you have an iWatch on your wrist right now, it's monitoring the way that you move. It's monitoring your health. It's monitoring a lot of things. And more, there are things that we wear or that we interact with that are monitoring how we move. And physical therapists are uniquely positioned to be able to help either further advance that innovation, to help interpret the information that's coming off of those devices, or to be on the side of advising people what they should and shouldn't do with that information. Because if we don't do it, if physical therapists don't do it, someone else is going to do it. Engineers are going to do it. Engineers are very smart, but they don't have the knowledge that physical therapists have. Physicians are very smart, but all physicians do not have the knowledge that physical therapists have. And so we are uniquely positioned when it comes to the assessment of human movement in society to be at the table, if not at the head of the table when it comes to the discussions about what we should do with this human movement data.
Yeah.
And it's only going to get more advanced.
Yeah. I mean, I teach a geriatrics course, and we talk a lot about technology and how it's improving and how it can help the geriatric population. And we're kind of getting into that sweet spot now where the baby boomers are tech savvy, at least, right? Where the last generation, maybe not so much. It was tough. You had to teach grandma how to use the remote control. But now baby boomers know how to use technology. They're not completely, you know, out to lunch. So it's one of those things where it's like, look, I love the terms that you use there, advising and consulting, right? Those are things that we can do as physical therapists in these tech companies that are using wearables, that are using safety devices and things that technology are helping with the older populations. I mean, even with the younger populations too, but all human movement and all, health-wise, that's something that we can definitely stake our claim in, you know? So, you know, I hope people are waking up to this. I hope it, because it seems like it's all doom and gloom on the internet when it comes to, you know, physical therapy as a profession. And truth be told, there are a lot of problems for sure. There, you know, I don't see reimbursement turning around and taking a step up anytime soon.
No.
So, okay, let's call it what it is. If that's the big issue, well, then let's find other ways to monetize it. Let's find other ways to find our value and provide value to the world and not have to worry about reimbursement.
So yeah, I agree.
I hope people are at least becoming aware.
As a young person, it's a lot easier to do the physical tasks that are necessary as a physical therapist, right? And appropriately so, because that's kind of where you learn what it means. You got to fail at everything you do to be able to get better at it. We fail with our patients early in the early years, and then we learn, oh, that didn't work because of this, or I think it didn't work because of this. But as you gain that knowledge, you gain that experience, you gain that wisdom, then you're able to eventually start to advise other people. There's also that loss of the desire or the physical ability to be squatting and resisting and throwing balls and doing all the stuff that we did when we were younger physical therapists. So I think there's value in the knowledge that you've gained of human movement and the ability for people to endeavor towards something and seeing if they succeed or don't succeed. I'm not saying it just is older physical therapists that need to do that, but there's this natural progression, and you don't just have to go into administration. There's other places where physical therapists with the knowledge they've gained through their careers can go, but younger physical therapists can move right into that space as well. It's just there's maybe just like anything, the more knowledge you have, the more experience you have, kind of the better off you're better positioned you're going to be to be in those positions.
Yeah. Well, Blaze, it's been an absolute pleasure catching up with you, man. And just, you know, I love hearing your journey and just, you know, seeing the wild twists and turns it took. I mean, as somebody who went from an English major to physical therapist to professor, I can appreciate the nonlinear path. We like to ask all of our guests this one final question. And that question is, if you could change one aspect of higher education, whether it be DPT or otherwise, what aspect would you change and how would you change it?
That's a hard one, Scott. So higher education, what would I change and why would I change it? And having been in higher education for almost 20 years, one of the hardest things for higher education right now is all the peripheral things that professors and department chairs and deans have to deal with. In some ways, I bragged a little bit earlier about we set up a business within the university and they didn't know how to deal with that. I think universities have become big businesses and the focus on education has become, I don't want to say lost, but maybe not quite at the forefront of what we're doing. The monetization of what higher education is hard to manage. I don't know how I would change that. I think if I could change something, I think it would be to try to reevaluate the prioritization of education over some of the other monetization that's going on in higher education. my time in higher ed was good for me personally. And I think being a professor in a graduate program, I was a bit spoiled because we did have smaller classes and we did have the ability to spend a lot of time with our students. But I know I would like to think that our students got a lot out of the money that they paid for their education, because they got that one-on-one time and they got a meaningful skill as they came out. I think it's a natural progression where higher education has gotten to where it has, but I would like to see us maybe take a step back and focus a lot more on the education of things and not so much the monetization.
Well, and that goes for healthcare too, right? I mean, it's become big business. You know, it's healthcare has become more of a business than it used to be as well. So, like you said, it's kind of all trending toward that natural progression towards more capitalism, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a hard balance, I know, but we want to advance as a country. We want to make sure that everyone has opportunity to have an education. At the same time, where do you set the criteria for what higher education is? And then is there an actual financial barrier to people doing that? And then does everyone deserve that degree? It's a really messy sort of thing. And what happens, I think, is it ends up washing out a lot of the degrees. And so you get maybe part of what's happening here, at least in physical therapy, is there's a lot of physical therapy schools out there. We're educating a lot of physical therapists. There's a need for sure, but have we flooded the market now with physical therapists? I don't know the answer to that. You might probably know that answer better than I do.
Not yet, but I'll tell you what. Yeah. We're at a rate of new PT schools opening up at, you know, 4 or 5 per quarter right now. And so at what point is enough enough? You know, so we're not there yet, but we're en route, you know?
Yeah. So I don't know. It feels like a bit of a, I don't know, it's not a definitive answer, but that's kind of what strikes me.
I'm not the expert on this. That's why we bring people like you on to talk about the expertise and knowledge they have, because, you know, I sure as hell don't know how to solve it, but I'm sure some of you do. So that's why we pick our guests, and that's why we ask that question at the end. Blaze, absolute pleasure talking with you, man. Where can people find you or reach out to you if they have questions or follow up or just want to see what you're up to these days?
It's hard to find me. What I would say is I'm really proud of the place that I work. You know, if you go to Nike.com or you look up the NSRL on the Google, you can find some pretty cool videos out there. You might see my face pop up in some of those videos, but I'm part of a much larger group of people that are doing some cool stuff.
Awesome. Well, we'll drop that link in the show notes so people can see your amazing face and that bald, beautiful head of yours. Blaze, always a pleasure, man. Like I said, I can't thank you enough for taking your time to come on here and share your story with us. It was really good time.
Thanks, Scott.
Well, I hope that episode was entertaining as much as it was informational and educational. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our past episodes, we ask you to please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. And please share out the episodes to those who you feel may be able to benefit from them. We also urge you to follow us on all social media platforms at HET Podcast and let us know what topics or experts you would like to hear from in future episodes. And just as a reminder, none of the information on today's show should be considered medical advice. It's simply infotainment or edutainment to help educate our audience. For medical advice, we always advise you to reach out to your preferred medical professionals, and we'll see you on the next show.